So when we are then connected to God, that's when we are the most human, is the way in which we are connected to God. And so, of course, then the loving thing to do for God is to help us flourish in that and to come alongside for our flourishing. Now, it doesn't always feel that way, right? Because some of us prefer, a sort of shrunkenness in certain areas of our life because we think it's where we're going to flourish.
Yeah.
But that's built on a distortion of our own soul and a mixed up love, a disordered love.
You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Kevin and Brandon, if each of you were each other for a day, how do you think your day would be spent?
Can you pick one? Can you pick a certain day?
I would go with a Wednesday.
Okay, got it.
It's a Wednesday.
Well,
is this
a
aspirational, like, or like a legit, this is how I think Brandon spends his Wednesday?
I think of what you know of each other.
This is going to be so offensive.
How would you... How would Brandon spend his Wednesday?
You gotta go first.
Oh, how would Kevin spend his Wednesday?
All right.
Oh, Wednesdays.
Well, from what I know of Kevin, I would wake up at 4 a.m. and I would go out and I would find my super rare single origin coffee from a small village in Nicaragua that I sourced.
Kenya, actually, but it's fine.
Same it must continent. Be, no, I'm just kidding.
The coffee cherries had to have been authentically sun-dried. If it was dried by any man-made process, he can taste it.
Wet processed.
So anyway, I would put that in a pour over. Somehow I wake up and my hair is already perfect. I don't know how.
Well, today I'm not having a good hair day, though. So today is not that Wednesday, but it's okay.
Well, it's not Wednesday.
That's fair.
Can't expect that on a Monday. I'm not...
Settles down by the middle of the week.
By the middle of the week, yeah. It comes into its own.
So coffee, I do some...
You're on track.
I do some breath prayers and I sniff my coffee and walk around the kitchen.
So now we're at 4:45 in the morning. What else do I do?
So now you read something from some ancient theologian about the olfactory sense and how... Well, you're smelling your coffee is actually connecting you to the Holy Spirit. I'm not that wrong.
You're not that wrong. That's why I'm laughing so hard.
Anyway, so, you know, your morning, your kids wake up and you do all this stuff. You take the kids, that kind of stuff. Then
it's true.
And you come into work and you look to see if my car is here and and you think, man, should I go talk to Brandon? And you come up to my door and you kind of hover with your hand just barely touching. And you hear me in there writing songs and you're like, you know, I don't want to ruin it. I don't want to ruin it. And then you walk to your office and you write your sermon. And for lunch.
Don't want to ruin it.
For lunch, you have little crackers. I don't think you've eaten
yet. Too
many
carbs and crackers.
I don't think you've eaten yet today.
I think Wednesday,
you've only had the coffee.
I've only...
Wednesday's a day off from the bars.
Yeah, from the bars. Now, usually it's a Greek yogurt. I pull the Dave Vergara. You know Dave Vergara?
Yes.
The Greek yogurt and the berries. That's my go-to breakfast.
Oh, I thought that was Dan. Dan will insert a block of cheese into that.
Dan drops the chunk
of
cheese.
He wants dairy upon dairy.
Yeah. How dare he?
Anyway, but then it really...
You're not too far off.
Where it's really a good Wednesday. You know, you do your... You do some meetings, you handle some emails, you know, some people complaining about your message. You kind of just gently talk to them about that.
Forward them over to Brandon Passion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then after your day, maybe you leave around, 4:30, have a good day. You look around the parking lot and see no one else's car. So you get a tiny bit resentful that you stayed longer than everybody. But then you go back home and you start cooking dinner, and you cook some kind of Turkish sausage dish for your family. And you,
Turkish sausage.
You explain
say
to
that
Lindsay,
10 times fast, by the way. That is.
You explain to Lindsay why this dish is such an important but rare dish, and why she's so lucky, and she doesn't even care.
Know it.
She's like, "Wow, Kevin, I'm just gonna eat it, okay?" And you feel a little bit rejected.
Just a little.
And then you all get together and make homemade ice cream at night. And you watch a little bit of Ted Lasso, and then you, you go to sleep at 9:30.
That's well done. That's well done. A few gaps, but that's not bad. That's not bad. I don't know how to follow that. So Brandon, if I were Brandon, and it's a Wednesday, I'd wake up a little later. I'm thinking I'd wake up at you. I think drop the girls off at school though. I've heard you talk through that, so I'm guessing you're up at 6:30.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Okay, 6:37. You're rolling out of bed. Your hair. If I were you, I would probably work on my hair, and I'd probably do a little effort there.
That would be a big upgrade for me.
If I worked on my hair every day. If I'm you, I'm inserting meaning into your hair right now, into your life. So I'd do a little bit of that. Let's see. My guess though is by 6:45, you've already sung the soundtrack of Hamilton once, at least once. And then by breakfast, you're on to Guys and Dolls, I would imagine. And so you're singing that with your kids, who I think have perfect pitch.
Luck be a lady tonight.
So now it's, I'm guessing, 7 a.m. And we've already been through two musicals as a family. And
it's hard to get stuff done, you know, when you have so much singing to do.
Oh, I imagine you guys just sing throughout your house all the time. Like you're singing, making waffles or like whatever it is. Like you're just constant musical because your family's crazy talented.
We do sing a lot, actually.
So then by, I'm guessing you, I was going to say that you would get dressed and ready for the day, but I don't know if that's the case. I think you just roll in as a creative. You can't allow.
I currently am wearing your bleach stained sweats.
You can't allow the creative juices to be hampered by a belt. You know what I mean? You got to let it fly. And that saves you some time. That saves you like 3 minutes of getting dressed. So you just roll in then. And I imagine then you come in. My car is probably here. And you, you roll into the office and then you start crafting some. Beautiful songs, some to the Lord, some to friends. But you're writing songs, planning the worship thing. My guess is you've probably got coffee or lunch with somebody.
So when Kevin came in, just so you know, listener, when Kevin came in, I played him a brand new song that I'd been working on for a friend of mine that was called Sand in the Band-Aid.
Sand in the Band-Aid, Sand in the Band-Aid. Sand in the Band-Aid.
It was a friend of mine that said, can you write a song about getting sand in my Band-Aid? Because he was at the beach. And so I did. Anyway.
So now I imagine, hey, you know, you're working for a few hours. And I bet, you know, you get a few hours of work in doing the worship thing. And then I would guess, let's see, you're probably heading home. Yeah, you're probably heading home. I feel like you're here late. Actually, I see you kind of leave in the middle of the day and then you often are back here for rehearsals or things.
Yeah.
You leave in the middle of conversations sometimes.
So me and you would be having a conversation with me and then you'd just leave. You'd just be gone and I'd be like, okay, I guess we're done. And then my guess is you do go home to make dinner. I'm thinking Katie cooks though. You don't strike me as a chef. Maybe you do cook?
Yeah, she cooks most
of
the time.
Okay, so I nailed that. That's correct.
The sound of your voice.
So anyway, that's my take.
How long has this been out, Rachel, that we've been talking about her?
I think it's Wednesday now. Here we are.
That day is upon us.
Kevin, you started yesterday with this idea of acceleration.
Yeah.
And the goal of technology, you said, was like easy everywhere.
Yeah.
And the idea was to give us more time. Mm-hmm. Explain the fallacy of that a little bit.
Yeah, so I steal that phrase from Andy Crouch in his book, TechWise Family, which is really good, small book that'll... anyway, it's worth a read. But he actually talks about how the goal of technology in easy everywhere isn't so much like necessarily aimed at just giving you more time, although that's one of the... what we believed would be the byproducts of any technological advance. But his whole thing is like, if technology is easy everywhere, and I think one of the examples he uses is think of like the way we make coffee, right? It moved from, you know, that kind of slow pour over method of coffee for decades into the Keurig where you just throw the pod in the thing and you hit one button and out comes coffee. Now, like, his whole point is easy everywhere doesn't always actually mean it's what we want, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and some of the more challenging things, and I think the reason I picked up on this in the intro of the sermon is some of the things that we most deeply want and desire don't actually happen easily, and that's by intention, right? Like, when we're talking about formation of character or spiritual formation, you can't easy everywhere that. I would argue a good cup of coffee is something that it shouldn't be easy everywhere, right? Like, to get a better cup of coffee, it's going to take time. It's the difference between like fast food and a sit down 2-star rated, you know, Michelin rated restaurant, right? Like, they both at the end of the day fill your stomach with some level of nutrition, but one we kind of inherently know is going to be better than the other, right? And there's that kind of intent that goes along with it. And so I think it's this myth of acceleration, this myth of innovation, is particularly in our area, in the Bay Area, we just assume easy everywhere is exactly what we desire and want. And so let's keep pursuing easy everywhere. And it reduces kind of the meaning of life down from, again, that some things are worth work, are worth effort, that are harder to get to. And I think that transition statement I used in there was just like, there's no way to short circuit the formation of our souls. Mm-hmm. And when we map that myth of technology onto spiritual formation, we come up drastically short, but it just takes time. Like, there's no shortcut for the formation of a soul.
Yeah. I feel like the patience that it takes is especially hard, like, when you're younger. And was really interesting when you said it used to be that we would have to go, was this Andy Crouch who said this? We'd have to go at the pace of digestion.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That, like, that basically we were, yeah, everything that was any productivity was done by a human or an animal.
Yeah. And the quickest they could move, right? If you just think of an energy transfer, you have to take in food and your body processes that and turns that into energy for you. And then you can exert energy producing a product, a thing, whatever it is. And that was what stalled all production. Like, that was, or stalled, maybe not even be the right word, but that was the pace at which production took place. Mm. And so the Industrial Revolution comes along and you insert machines and assembly lines, and all of a sudden it detaches that, where we can exceed our limitation of digestion. And all of a sudden we can produce things at a much quicker rate, which, again, there's always a shadow side to it, right? It's not that it necessarily made things inherently worse all the time, but we recognize what that did was it accelerated time. It in some ways commodified time, where it made it now a resource, a limited resource that we could exploit for greater consumption. I mean, really is what the Industrial Revolution comes down to. And so that altered the way we encountered life, right? Mm-hmm. And again, we tend to, the reach of the Industrial Revolution has gone into every corner of life, and that we can kind of mechanize every part of our world, including our spiritual life. And we can buy that myth, thinking that we can expedite that as well.
This is kind of like the, what you're talking about is sort of like the double-edged sword of efficiency.
Yeah.
Like, efficiency has become sort of a god. Yeah. Almost like it's very respected. If you're an efficient mm-hmm. human being, mm-hmm. it's very respected. I mean, you get so much done. I can, you know, I was just in Iowa, and we going to my family's in like Des Moines area. We passed through Amana Colonies, which is like an Amish settlement. Mm. So when they went there in the 1800s or something like that, it was, I mean, there's right now there's not much there, but yeah. back then there was nothing. I mean, they just went to the middle of nowhere and developed these colonies. And I got to think that a piece of all of that is to fight against the god of efficiency, right? Yeah. I don't know. I don't know necessarily all of the, you know, theology of the Amish people, but
yeah. mm-hmm.
but the reason they resist technology, that was sort of their solution of saying, look, we will intentionally do it slow.
Yeah. Mm. And part of the reason, and this is, I'm speaking a little bit out over my skis on it too, because I'm not as familiar with Amish theology or whatnot, but I do know that part of the reason they're so hesitant about embracing technological change is because they're asking the question that I asked yesterday of, like, what is this doing to our soul? Mm. Like, they're leery of any change because they take seriously the impact it could have on a soul, right? Like, Like, and I always think through, like, could you imagine sitting in a room when they're talking about, like, should we embrace the iPhone? You know what I mean? Like, in an Amish community, like, how they would navigate that thought would be fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, because they have technology, right? They've got, like, whether it's a horse and a buggy or cars or whatnot, like, they've embraced some elements of it. But they, yeah, but they're, like, hesitant to just kind of willy-nilly embrace anything that comes their way, right? Which, yeah. So I think it's a good posture to think through, like, the things we do, the things we use, all of that in our world do something to us. So we should be conscious of that and kind of think through, what is this going to do in turn to me and my soul and my connection with Jesus and others? And we should probably evaluate that a little bit.
It's like a rhythm of intentionality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
I will tell you that there are areas in life that I know I'm addicted to efficiency and where it would be hard to coexist without some things. And it would be almost impossible to coexist with other people in the world without certain things. So I remember when I realized this, I had this great idea that, you know, I would downgrade my phone. You know, Rachel is still operating on an iPhone 6. God bless her. God bless her.
Consider it the downgrade.
Rachel, is that like a, is that a, you know, intentional move on your part? Are you?
No, it's rebellion without a cause.
Rebellion without a cause.
I'm waiting for Instagram to not work because then I'll feel like it's a good thing.
There's a lot of things that Rachel can't participate in because her phone is too old.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
And I'm low key jealous of that. I'm legit. I'm a little bit low key jealous. It's so good. A
couple years ago, though, I tried to downgrade to back to an old phone I had where it flips open. I think it was called the Voyager.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you're holding it like
flips open,
sideways.
Has the keyboard.
Yeah.
No navigator.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all these different things like that.
Do you by navigator mean maps, by the way? Do you call it navigator?
Navigator, yeah.
That's what they call it in the cars.
Is it?
Well, Navi.
So you get in the car and be like, hey, got to fire up the navigator?
Well, it was originally called VZ Navigator. That was like the first, well, besides, unless you had like a fancy TomTom or something.
Okay, all right.
And it would give you step. I remember when VZ Navigator came out and I was like, this thing tells me where to go. This is mind blowing.
This is amazing.
Before that, I have to go on MapQuest before the journey, print it out.
You and hope you don't miss a turn. Yeah. Got dark quick.
Or the Atlas.
Yeah.
I tried to go back to this old phone and I could not do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It was just, I mean, it was this grand gesture of, oh, you know what? I'm going to fight the power
fight
of the iPhone.
Yeah.
And I failed.
And I
lost.
Shoot.
Yeah.
So remaining. The word menno, and I asked you, I think I asked you last week, is that where Mennonite comes from? It is not.
Oh, it is not. Did you look it up?
Menno Simons is the founder of the Mennonites.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm sure his name is rooted in word menno.
Yeah.
But,
good call. I should have remembered that. That's smart.
But this idea of remaining, you guys talked about this idea of Jesus says, remain in me as I also remain in you. And you talk about this kind of mutual indwelling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a beautiful, I mean, it really is a beautiful verb, if I could say so. I don't know if how nerdy that sounds, but it is one like where what Jesus riffs on is this again, I don't know. I was struck by it being that one of the last conversations he has with his disciples before his death. And that sort of like famous last words. And he spends so much time on this concept of abiding where he says, I will abide in you, right? Primarily through the work of the Holy Spirit, and you will abide in me. You'll remain in me. And it's this sort of beautiful mutual indwelling, which the only really other, at least the only other example I can think of right now of that is the inner dimensions of the Trinity, right? Like in the way that the Father loves the Son, loves the Spirit. And like they're, like this sort of remaining in or abiding in mutual indwelling is the substance of the Trinity. And so it's fascinating to me that Jesus kind of picks this up again, not saying that we are the fourth member of the, I don't know what you'd call a Trinity with four members, but not that we're like that at all, but it's the idea that we're invited into that relationship in which God now will indwell us as we indwell in God and make our home in God. Like it's a sort of just beautiful analogy in that. And there's that becomes then the sort of life-giving force or framework for how we thrive in really any way in this life. And of course, the example that Jesus uses, I think, so well is that idea of the branches and the vine. And that as long as a branch is connected to its life source, its main branch or vine, it will continue to flourish. And that's really all it has to do, right, is just stay connected to the vine, because within that vine is where the life energy and life source is flowing. And so that's this in the same way. And so that life force flows into the branches as the branches abide in it. And there's this sort of mutual indwelling where they really become, you know, not one, but there is this growing in union where they become. That's, again, what Paul would love. He loves that imagery of union with Christ. And that's when I think Jesus, right there, a few hours before his death, right, is kind of laying out as this, above all, this is what we do as followers of Jesus.
So yesterday, Kevin, you talked about how verse 2, just reading about the branches being thrown to the fire can feel harsh. And here you said that it's not necessarily chastisement, but for edification. So in what way is Jesus assuring his disciples through this passage, and how do we sit with verse 2?
Yeah, verse, you know, that second verse is talking about God as the gardener, and how he, in some ways, you oversee the whole kind of process of the growth, if you will. And I think it's a good analogy, because when he talks about pruning and cutting away, it's God moving kind of into our lives in a way that allows the vine to flourish. I was talking to Janet Trites, I think it was before service, and maybe even she said it in our team huddle, but she was talking about how that analogy she loves, because someone who's a gardener that she knows or something said, you know, I'm never closer to the vine than when I'm pruning it, which I thought was a really beautiful example of that. Like, we tend to think of pruning and getting rid of as this sort of harsh movement of God. And it's like, and sometimes it can be difficult, like, no doubt. But a gardener only prunes, only moves closer to a vine and gets in kind of the weeds of it, if you will, in order for it to flourish, because he wants and desires, or she wants and desires, for it to flourish. And so in the same way, like, when God is pruning, he's looking and he's helping convict us of the areas in which we are not growing, or we're not being fruitful, the things that deter us away from that fruitfulness. And in that, like, that's that harsh work of pruning. Like, it is, again, a challenge. Like, it's a, in some ways, pruning in some level is a violent process, right? You're cutting off that which doesn't belong. And so in the same way, like, that's what God, I think, is after as in his role as the gardener, and is working through those different areas of our life that aren't flourishing in the way that they could. But it's a posture of love. It's not a posture of a harsh, mean, I can't wait to chop this thing up kind of way, right? Like, it's all bent on the idea of its own flourishing. And that's what a gardener is doing.
And it's not really even a threat, right? I feel like some people read this part as a threat. Like, hey, it's this beautiful, loving, like, I'm going to abide in you. I'm going to remain in you, and you remain in me.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you don't remain in me, I'm going to send you to hell. Like, you're going to burn. I just feel like I know it's nuanced, but I feel like sometimes people read it that way.
Yeah. Well, and that's, like, I think that's why I brought out Augustine's kind of view of what happens to the human under sin. Like, in that idea of, like, we shrivel up, we shrink up. I think it's so helpful, because it kind of removes, or it places the conversation of sin more in the ways that it is less of just like a strict, you broke my rules and so now you're in trouble, but more in the vein of, like, you know, the reason these things are, quote, sin or whatnot is because it's doing something to you. It's hindering you from being fully human in the way in which God has created you. And so when then we are caught in or connected to a branch other than God, or, you know, whatever it is we are shriveling, right? That's the idea of the sponge that I use from a guy named Graham Walker, where he just says, like, that sponge that's crusty, like, it's just not what it was intended to be. And so in the same way we were intended to be connected to and permeated with God, so to a sponge is meant to be permeated with water, where it's that's when it's its most sponginess, right? So when we are then connected to God, that's when we are the most human, is the way in which we are connected to God. And so, of course, then the loving thing to do for God is to help us flourish in that, and to come alongside for our flourishing. Now, it doesn't always feel that way, right? Because some of us prefer, you know, sort of shrunkenness in certain areas of our life because we think it's where we're going to flourish.
Yeah.
But that's built on a distortion of our own soul and a mixed up love, a disordered love that's pursuing something other than what we were created for. So you're right. Like, and so then when he gets to verse six, you know, he says, what is, what's it say? If you do not remain in me and you are like a branch that is thrown away and withers, such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire and burned. We think of that so much as like this casting into hell. Like God can't wait to scoop up the branches and burn them. And I think it's a little more like that's just the natural process of someone who's disconnected to God. They slowly shrivel up. They slowly become less and less human. And that becomes the metaphor he's using is that's kind of the natural trajectory of a branch. Like, you know, like honestly, yesterday in my living room, we've got this plant that I think is dying. I'm not quite sure, but it lost some branches and they fell and they've been sitting there for a few days. They're withering, they're shriveling up. And at some point I pick them up and I throw them away because that's just the direction they go.
You don't burn them?
Yeah.
I don't burn them.
You don't have a bonfire in the backyard. The burn days, they wouldn't like that.
They wouldn't like it. But anyway, so I think it is that it's more of a that sort of natural trajectory. You know, what I mean? I think it was, I meant to look this up before, but I think it was C.S. Lewis who talked about, you know, hell's door is locked from the inside. That it's far more our own choosing to not come to God and step into that like flourishing life, but rather, you know, almost of our own choosing. And we continually, those who don't embrace the way of Jesus and the way of, you know, the forgiveness and grace of God, but rather consciously rebel against it. Oh, that's in some ways that's the, you know, the natural trajectory of a life bent inward is towards that sort of selfishness.
I guess in some ways the pruning like reflects God's faithfulness even as a gardener. Cause I think even if the gardener who comes to our house and every now and then it kind of looks like he just went and killed everything because he like cut it. But in order for the plants to grow, he has to. But I think remembering that one, that he's a gardener, that's what he does. And two, that he's trustworthy. We've had him as our gardener for so long. It's not that he wants our garden to look really bad. It's that he cares about the growth of the plants and their well-being too. Yeah. So I think even that connection back, I remember how Janet closed out the service with a benediction reminding us of remaining in his love and the love of the gardener too. It's another reminder that it's not chastisement or just for the sake of inflicting pain, but it's out of the purpose of love.
Yeah.
And I think shows his faithfulness when we remain in him to not just leave us as we are, but to bring us more to how he intended us to be.
Yeah. That's good. Even if you read one verse further, so we stopped at verse 8. But if you read verse 9, Jesus continues, he says, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you, now remain in my love. Right. And so he ties, like he essentially, Jesus is saying like the goal, the telos, the trajectory of all of it, right, is for us to become more and more people of agape, more and more people of love. And so that pruning, like you said, I love that, is it's cutting away that which isn't turning us into people of love or that is hindering us from embracing God's love. I think that's a great analogy, Rachel.
So how do we know if we are abiding?
Yeah.
There may be people listening and they're like, how do I know? Am I abiding? How do you know? Because you can't always tell in the middle of it.
Yeah. And I think, that's a really good question. Cause I think it is like in the moment, it's can be hard to tell, like, am I doing the right thing or whatnot? I think part of that is that problem of acceleration where we expect instant results. We think, oh yeah, this morning I woke up and I abided in the vine. And so now look at me, I'm Mother Teresa or something. Like we just expect it to happen in an instant. But there's no shortcut to it. Like this abiding in the same way that a branch, you know, when we hit springtime and leaves start to show back up on the branches, that's a process that takes months, right? It takes time. And so in the same way, like, when we know we're abiding is when we begin to slowly see the fruit of a life, you know, a life of Christ likeness in our own life. But that takes time, right? That doesn't happen overnight. Like, and just think through some of the commandments of Jesus. And again, the quintessential one I always come back to is like loving your enemies. You don't learn to do that overnight. It's a conscious choice to start becoming the kind of person who loves their enemies. But to love your enemy, it has to come from like the natural disposition of them. You have to be able to view them with essentially the image of God in them, with a care where you genuinely desire their betterment than their destruction. And that, that just takes time. And so I think one of the ways we can, we have to reorient to know if we're abiding is we have to start looking in decades, right? Like that's often one of the things I, it's a question I'm asking myself now where I'm in my mid to late 30s is like, who am I going to be in my mid to late 40s? Right. And I'm trying to think through in decades instead of what am I going to do next week? What am I going to, you know, how will I shape by the fall? Like, it's like, no. Like who am I going to become in 10 years? And my hope, my deep desire is that if you were to talk to somebody that knew me in my mid to late 20s and they then kind of, you know, randomly, like haven't been around me and all of a sudden they encounter me now. I hope they'd notice a difference. I hope they'd see like, yeah, he's grown in patience or he's not as big a jerk as he was. Or like he tends to maybe has a little more joy than he was in his mid to late 20s. But I don't know. We have to reorient and think through like the cultivation of the fruit of the Spirit that Paul talks about doesn't happen quickly. And when we begin to kind of reorient around the immediate and step into a space where it's like, no, who am I becoming 10 years from now? That's, I think, how we have to learn how, you know, where we find out if we're abiding in that long term.
So you say in order to remain connected that we have to deal with this chaos. You know, you kind of drew that squiggly, the squiggly lines with the cross in the middle and then, you know, orienting, organizing our lives around Jesus gave us the smooth, I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
the clean lines around
and
allowing the cross to be at the center of everything. And you use this quote, I think from an old professor.
Yeah.
Discipline joins desire.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah. That's Susan Phillips, who teaches at New Berklee College, I think it is. And she's, gosh, she might be one of the most brilliant teachers I've ever sat with. She's
not to be confused with the famous horn arranger, John Philip Sousa.
Which is
a similar name.
That is. Huh. I personally would not have made that mistake. I have not heard of the horn arranger.
Seriously?
I have not. Yeah.
Wow.
Should I have?
Yeah.
On Wednesday, you learn about that.
I know you know his songs. You for sure know his songs.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry, anyway, continue.
I disappointed you.
So John Philip Sousa said.
But she... So she talks about in her book, again, The Cultivated Life, which is, it's a beautiful book. It's worth reading. She talks about the contrast between circus living and the cultivated life. And she talks about that circus living, which I love that analogy, right? Because it's, you get, it's a visceral picture of like the circus is loud. It's chaotic. There's this and that, and you're running from one event to the next and like all that sort of thing that tends to organize our life when we don't step into it with intentionality. Mm-hmm. And if there's one kind of like, I think it's, we take that, we embody and kind of absorb that way of living. And then we just want to layer on the Jesus-y stuff, almost like it's a hobby, right? Like we just want to throw Jesus on as another thing. And like, yeah, I'll just, you know, I got a little time on Friday morning to do the Jesus thing. And so I'll spend that time doing it. But the problem is that that's a very unintentional way to go about forming into the kind of person who's, you know, oriented by agape love, right? Like that takes way more than that. And so the idea then is that if we can move from the circus living into this sort of wholeness, it's the visual of like, how do we step out of the unintentional formation where it's like, I just am going to throw a little bit of time at things and hope that Jesus shows up. And God uses that. Like, I don't want this to be a shame thing. Like God will use whatever efforts we can give, even if it is just a little. But the idea for the follower of Jesus is saying, what if there was a way to orient the whole of our life around Jesus? And this is another great book is Practicing the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence. It's a little tiny book. And I've referenced it a few times. But he talks about, you know, he was a monk, which obviously made his life a little privy to organizing around Jesus. But he has this great line though, where he talks about how God was no less present to him than when he was doing dishes in the kitchen, that was his task in the monastery, was just doing dishes, versus when he was at the Holy Eucharist table, which he's Catholic. And so everything is about the Eucharist. And I think that's a beautiful depiction because what he's saying there is that there's a way in which you can go about the very ordinary things of your life, like doing dishes or laundry or running to and from work, where you are aware and present to God in that moment, to where God is just as present there as at the Eucharist, right? And that I think is what it means when we begin to say, okay, there are some habits that we'll need to change that distract us away from the way of God. There are other things that we can then leverage to just become more aware of God. So like one of the things I do is I often, before I go into a meeting, whatever it is, I literally just spend a moment saying, God, you're here and help me be aware of that.
Did you do it before this meeting?
I didn't do it before this meeting.
Classic.
It's Monday morning.
But by Wednesday.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
But it's how do we leverage the ordinary things of our life and just, I think this is what Paul means when he says pray continually. Hmm. I don't think he actually means sit with hands folded and pray, but he means like orient your whole life around the presence of God.
There's definitely a woodpecker outside.
It's a big one. But he's present in that.
In the woodpecking.
He created the woodpecker. Okay, so I was going to go into, I had a good transition here. What you're really talking about here, Kevin, is spiritual formation. And I will tell you, you know, when I started engaging this really seriously, maybe, 4 years ago or so, I had to look this idea of spiritual discipline in the eyes and acknowledge that I hated it. Hmm. I don't like that word. And I think that I would like to think that I'm not alone.
Yeah. And I don't think you are.
When we think about that and we think of even the phrase you used, rule of life, we hear the word rule and we hear the word discipline. And for me anyway, it brings to mind this this really rigid, almost like angry, miserable practice of religion.
Mm.
And it's the thing that, you know, I've sort of rebelled against my whole Christian life, is this idea that like that you have to follow this strict set of boundaries, and if you don't, God's gonna, you know, burn you up like the branches in the vine. And I feel like even as we, you know, talk about this rule of life, we kind of can, there's something in me that reacts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, what you laid out yesterday, it's actually really not about law, is how kind of juxtapose rule and law.
Yeah.
Explain that a little bit more, because I feel like that was really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, rule is like, it's ancient language, and we import kind of modern understandings of rule, which is why we tend to think of rules for life, not just like, even though the phrase is rule of life. And part of that, particularly the difference between like rule and law, is law is guilt innocence based, right? You either abide by it or you don't, right? And that's kind of it. Like there's no nuance, there's no flexibility. But this idea of rule or regula in the Latin is this idea much more of like of kind of like think of like a ruler almost, like in the sense of it being like a straight edge. That is what you, when you're drawing whatever and you need a straight edge, like that's your guide. It's the thing that's helping you arrive at that straight line. But it's a model, right? Like the goal isn't the ruler itself. It's something that you're aspiring to. And so in the same way, like the rule is adaptable opposed to a law that's rigid. A rule is something that allows flexibility because its goal is not to adhere to it, but rather to bring about a different purpose. And that's where I think the metaphor of the trellis is helpful, which again, there's some debate on whether or not regula is where we get our English word trellis, but there's some correlation to it.
Who is having that debate? What two nerds are sitting in a room like, well, actually, I know that you think that's trellis, but when you really think about it.
Well, that's how I spend my Thursdays, Brandon. Yeah, that's my Thursdays. So we didn't get to that.
But. Theology Thursdays.
But it's again, though, like the trellis isn't, the goal isn't the trellis, right? Mm. And the same is with the rule of life. Like the goal isn't actually to live by a rule of life.
Mm.
The goal is that a rule of life is a tool to help us grow in Christ likeness, because that's the goal, is growing in Christ likeness. And so you can use any tool we want. Like the reason I think this idea of the rule of life has been so beneficial is because throughout church history, it's been something that for thousands of years, the church has cultivated this idea of a rule of life, this set of practices or habits that kind of they guide and guard our daily living. So in some ways, it's like at any point, if the tool you're using isn't helping you bring about the ends you want, well, then you'd be foolish to continue using that tool, right? Like that would just not be, you know, wise to do so. And so in the same way, like that's why a rule of life is also not, there's not like one set rule of life that we all have to do, but rather we enter into a rule of life and say, kind of like, here's what we believe for this season. We need particular sets of practices to help guard and guide our life in the modern world, which goes back even to the, you know, as I posed in the sermon, the main problem for us is acceleration. Like time is just moving faster and faster, which is why our first practice in our rule of life is saying attentiveness, slow down. We have to counter that because that's doing something to our souls. And so that first step for us is just slow down enough to become aware of God and yourself and where even your soul's at. Hmm. But again, it's that idea that it's not law, it's rule, it's invitation. It's a willful kind of stepping into, it's a structure to help something else come along. But I don't think you're alone. I think that idea of discipline, we do kind of at times resist. My guess is because we're good modern American individualists that think nothing from outside should prevent us from doing whatever we feel. But that's got all sorts of problems. But I mean, think about it with kids. Kids flourish under structure. A kid with no structure, right, is chaos.
Yeah.
But when you interject some structure and just kind of allow those sorts of kind of ironically rules or whatnot to help guide that child, they flourish. We all need that structure in some ways, whether we want it or not or feel it. Like we do need structure to help us flourish, some more than others. Like I think there is that in there too, but
I think it's the same with creativity too. Like,
yeah.
Like if you go for like songwriting, if you say, Brandon, write a song.
Yeah.
And I say about what? Just anything.
Sand in the band-aid.
Suddenly the everything in my mind, you know, starts like, how do I write? How do I write? Where do I, you know, you just kind of like get lost in the chaos of it.
Yeah.
If you were to say, write, you know, a specific song about this thing.
Yeah.
Those boundaries give me something to latch on to and allows me to create something. It would be so foolish of me to get stuck on if you said, well, Brandon, write a song about the beach, you know?
Yeah.
And then we'd just be so stuck on these, you know, beach narratives. And the whole point is that I write a song and you're just trying to provide some kind of structure.
Yeah.
Well, I would imagine like a particular key that you have to write in. That's a structure that limits your focus, right? Or time signature. Like writing a song within a particular time structure allows that song to flourish because it gives it rhythm, it gives it pace, it gives it coherence in some level. Like even, I think Brandon, you and I were talking about this, this idea, which I'm fascinated with, that structure helps creativity because it feels counterintuitive. But you were even talking about like, I think it was you, maybe someone else, but even like a painter, right? There's a limitation of the canvas in which those edges force them to work within that and then allow that the painting to come out of the canvas. Like we are people built on structure, whether it's overt or not. Like those sorts of things are necessary for our growth.
Yeah. I think being built in structure, the piece that stood out to me yesterday was how we're like grapevines, which are naturally climbing vines and need to find a structure. So in some ways we kind of push against certain types of structure, but we're built to be structured.
Yeah.
And I wonder like how a rule of life in that sense structures us in a way that helps us receive Jesus's love. Kind of like you said, it's not just for the sake of being structured or not just for the pain of the pruning, but
what
is the,
but to allow it to flourish. And those, again, and that's where we hold our structures loosely, right? Is, are they bringing about the ends we desire? Like we have to recognize that. Like, and this is where even all these things that we're kind of chasing after in the next few years, you know, there is a sense in these that they're not like, if at any point, you know, these things that we tell you to do or to try out or to test on or whatever, like if they hinder your growth in Jesus, don't do them. Right. Like that's not our goal. But what I think what we are praying through and working through and developing together, even in community of a staff and a church community, is that we believe these are time tested things the church has done for centuries that have helped followers of Jesus in the past. And so we're trying to lift up some of those things, something like silence and solitude, which the church has been practicing for a long time.
And Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jesus himself, right? And we're just trying to lift those up and place them into our context and say, these might be some of heightened importance given the factors that are shaping our world today. That's why I think, honestly, in the spring when we get to Sabbath, I think it's one of the paramount necessities of following Jesus in this day, because it gets back to this idea of acceleration. And I mean, I'm really excited actually to preach through that in March, which will be a little while, but I'm excited for that because I think it is one of those keystone practices that we have to figure out to follow Jesus in our day because of the unique pressures we face.
So give us your definition. You gave a definition yesterday for rule of life. Can you give us that again?
Yeah. So I said a rule of life is a set of practices that organize and orient the habits of our regular days to help us practice presence with Jesus and participate in his work in the world.
And you mentioned that will basically embody four different practices that we're going to go through over the next few years.
Yeah.
Hit those four real quick.
Yeah. So we organize, as we said, around the two goals of an apprentice of Jesus: presence with Jesus and participation with Jesus. And so two of those practices, attentiveness and renewing the mind, center on that idea of practicing presence. The idea with that is if we are to be transformed, we must first and foremost be present to Jesus and the Holy Spirit and the Trinity and all that sort of thing. And so then the other two organize our lives around the participation with Jesus, and those would be hospitality and vocation. And those are just a way in which we join in the very work that God's doing. And so it's in some ways you can even think of it through like the inner life and the outer life, the things that we're doing to shape who we are and the things we're doing to shape those around us. And both of those, you know, those two sets, presence and participation, have to come into these sorts of habits or structures or ways. Think of it almost like, again, a way of habituating the way of Jesus into our body, like where it becomes a part of the natural disposition of who we are.
I'll tell you, I'm in our life group. What are they called here? Small groups?
Community group.
Community groups. Gosh, dang.
Nailed it.
In our community group, we are addressing, we did this once as a staff to prep for all this last year, but we're addressing it again, the habit audit.
Yeah.
And so Katie and I have been doing,
terrifying, isn't it?
A habit audit of our days. And
yeah,
I remember you saying, maybe it was in an earlier sermon, sometimes you just feel like you're too busy to follow Jesus.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my habit audit and I kind of list out my schedule. I don't even have time in my schedule for bad habits.
Yeah.
It's just too busy. I just do too much. I mean, there are a few things where I can save, but you're talking about like, if I really want to make time, I have to change my day.
Yeah. Which could be worth saying that, because I'm with you, by the way. So whatever I say next is me very much included, is if we're that busy, if you're too busy to have bad habits, those things you're doing are bad habits, right? Like the busyness is the bad habit.
Gosh.
Like we're addicted to rush and hurry and pace and all of that. And what I love about the habit audit in particular is it's really hitting on this idea, like if you're still confused about what a rule of life is, like know this, all of us have a rule of life. All of us have a set pattern in which we live our regular days. Like there are, like you, I would guess almost everyone listening to this has like 75% of your morning is the same every single morning, right? Like largely, like there are interruptions and anomalies and all that sort of thing. But we all have a rule of life. It's just whether or not we've been intentional about it or not. And what we're suggesting is if, like, Brandon, you and I are thinking through that busyness, that chaos, like our rule of life is producing the squiggly line, right? That's just all over that chaos. And so what we're saying is, what if we took that rule of life we have, that regular set of habits we're doing, breathed intentionality into them, and just said, what if we were really intentional about our mornings, our days, our regular habits, to where they aren't the squiggly mess anymore, but could actually bring us and allow Christ to shine kind of through us. And so we all have one. It's just whether it's a good rule of life or not, whether it's bringing us more like Christ or not like Christ. And so that's really what this is trying to get us to do. And that's what I think what the habit audit hopefully does is it forces you to look at your current rule of life, say, is it bringing us closer to what we want and who we want to be?
Well, I think I figured out how to straighten one of the squiggly lines.
Yeah.
Olivia rides the bus. Olivia, rise the bus. I spent so
much. It's a new song idea.
I spent so much time driving that girl around. So we're gonna do this together. We want to hit this practice lab thing, guys. Yeah. This is gonna be such a great thing to do together. We already have a good amount of people signed up for this thing, but if you have not signed up yet, do it.
Mm. Where do they go to sign up, Rachel?
cpc.org/events.
Boom.
Wow. And go to the practice lab event. If you try to sign up at a different event, it won't work.
Yeah. It's different from Trunk or Treat. Too. Still fun. Yeah.
Still fun. Still good. And sign up for that as well.
We're going to practice it together. Because this is something that we don't have to try to reinvent the wheel there. Like you said, we're joining. It's new for us, kind of, but it's also like one of the oldest things that exists in our faith tradition.
Yeah.
So we're coming back to this and practicing this together. I think it's going to be really, really cool. And I will leave all of you with this. And Kevin, the last thing you said, and I don't think this was your quote. I think this was some...
Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Yes, that's right.
It's a heck of a name.
I forget Pierre.
That's a name. And I'm Kevin Sneed. That's such a cooler name than mine. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
That if you feel like you're getting impatient, maybe you hear 6 months and you're like, what? 6 months? How are we going to do 6 months of anything? It doesn't mean that we're not doing other ministry. It doesn't mean we shut down everything else. We shut down the church. Mm. It just means this is where we're going to focus our energy together.
Take one small step towards intentionality.
And so I'll leave you with Pierre's quote, trust in the slow work of God. Fruit does not burst onto the vine, as Kevin said. It happens over the course of...
You could say it doesn't gush like a fruit snack.
Yeah.
Fruit by the foot.
And with that, we'll talk to you next week.